Hello.
Hey, Jay, it's Dave here.
Hi, Dave. Welcome to rebooting the news.
Hey, let's reboot the news. So
yeah, hey. Let's get right to it. You have a boot, I'm sure.
I have a boot? I'm wearing boots, it's true. What does that have to do with anything? Do you want me to boot something?
I'm saying give a boot to our podcast and start us off.
Oh, you want me to boot? Okay, I got a nice list here. And we both put together lists.
Yes, so why don't you start off with an item of
yours? There was one thing that neither of us put on our lists. I just realized that while I was getting ready, and that was Craig. We didn't do anything about Craig.
Craig Newmark?
Yeah, don't you remember? I mean, the Craig list murder?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what was your first reaction to that when you heard that?
Craig's a friend of mine, so I don't want to talk about it. I'm watching him, and you know it's a difficult situation. And I know Craig, so I feel I don't want to opine on it.
You don't? Okay.
No. Well,
I know him too, and I respect that. I guess it's. I felt very bad for Craig, and I would have even if I didn't know him. And I thought, I feel weird because you don't want to talk about this, so maybe we ought to just move on.
I would rather do that because of just a friendship issue.
Interesting. Okay. Then what about torture? Do you have any friends who are doing torture? Because, if you do, then we need to have we need to talk about that, Jay.
I'm very interested in what's been happening with the discussion of torture, and I'm, of course, very interested in the intersection with the press, and I've been putting items into my Twitter feed that reflect that undercurrent.
Do you have any conclusions?
Well, I have two conclusions. The first is that we have to keep in mind that part of the reason we know a lot about the torture that did happen is from reporting by the press. That is, the CIA black sites, the Abu Ghraib conditions, a lot of what we know about the chain of command all comes really from reporting. So there's that to consider. The press has uncovered the torture regime, but where it ran into trouble, this is my other conclusion, has to do with how the press constructs authority when there are conflicting truth claims. And the system that our journalists worked out was that when there are conflicting truth claims, you revert to a position of passing along the conflict, which is a kind of punting to the next stage of politics. And that system works when the actors involved stay within certain bounds that we might call consensus politics. It's vulnerable when one actor goes outside the consensus and takes action that is kind of like outside the rules, because they can simply play he said, she said back in the world of the rules, while continuing to actually violate the law, violate consensus, violate tradition, do something dangerous and wrong. And what happened with torture was that basically Dick Cheney gamed the he said, she said press, denied everything, and kind of put this opacity over the entire issue that took advantage of the fact that if a high enough authority disputes a fact, it can weaken the fact, and it can make it less of a fact, even when it's pretty obvious that the vice president is wrong. And he has used that power, he has built up that power, and he is sowing the seeds for a stab in the back narrative if there ever is another terrorist attack. So it's been fascinating for me to watch.
I see. What do you mean by that when you say stab in the back? If there's another terrorist.
Well, that's an extreme way of putting it. What I mean is that by saying he has made the country less safe, that if there is another attack, it's setting up a future narrative that we should have tortured throughout the Obama years, and then we wouldn't have had this attack. So that's there, as Mark Danner pointed out in the New York Review of Books. That story is there. It's like in the soil, waiting for the right conditions to come back up. And that's partly a product of the weaknesses of he said, she said journalism, but it's also a product of the politics under Bush and who Cheney is, and you know, the political class in Washington. So I've been watching that part of it, and it's fascinating and it's clarifying.
Well, there's also the possibility that there will be that there actually will be torture under the Obama presidency, and
maybe. Yeah, we don't know that.
Well, it certainly could happen even without Obama ordering it. And
yes,
you know, then
exactly.
You have to sort of look forward to what might happen then, because you have the Republicans now saying, and Obama himself has said this to some extent, that you know, let's look forward, let's not look backward, which is as crazy as the whole idea of not challenging the president when Bush was the president. The not looking back thing is crazy, because mm-hmm. if you don't do that, you absolutely guarantee that you'll have torture, that it will keep happening. The other thing that none of these arguments that I've heard in the press factor in is that the matter isn't even in our hands in the United States. It's not our call mm-hmm. as to whether or not there is a prosecution for torture, It's going to happen. I mean, there was this fantastic... You're right about the press covering this. There was a fantastic Fresh Air in 2008, in June of 2008, where Terry Gross interviewed a man named Philippe Sands, mm-hmm. who has a book called Torture Team. And it was a real eye-opening interview. And what he said, and he's not an American, he's British... and he had come to Washington, I believe he testified in Congress, and he said basically that there will be prosecutions for war crimes after mm-hmm. Bush left office. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. There was not a question about it, that they had, and that there had been, it was fascinating, because they have documents, and so it wasn't just the press,
it's way beyond the press.
Sands was doing this too.
Yeah,
they have situations where high up people in the Bush administration were trying to set up meetings with lower level people so that they could pass the buck on to them, and the lower level people wouldn't take the meetings because they all understood how the war. In other words, they were factoring in a lot of knowledge about how war crimes prosecutions go.
Right,
the way they were operating.
And that's right. And it's not something contained by the American political system.
Correct. And the problem I have is this is the United States, and I was raised to believe, I know it sounds corny, but I was raised to believe that we don't do stuff like this. And and so I am absolutely in favor of prosecution. I don't see how it can possibly be avoided. And I don't hear a lot of the dialogue. I don't think that it can be avoided, period. I think that would be a factual statement. I think it's going to happen. It has to happen. And I don't think that any reporting that says otherwise, that there is a debate. That's why I couldn't believe that tweet that came out of, who's the guy that does Meet the Press? David Gregory. He talked about the torture issue or the torture debate. I go, there can't be a debate about torture.
Well, there is, unfortunately. Well, what we can say, Dave, is that some facts get smaller as you recede from them. Events generally, most events, shrink as time moves on. But there's a certain category of events that actually get larger as time goes on, as we recede from them. And the events that... but involve the United States in acts of torture are in that category, they will grow. And as they enlarge, what happens is a lot of people who didn't have to question their responsibility do as the thing just continues on. And so it's going to be interesting to watch what happens from here, but it's part of being an American to try and find out the truth. I have not made up my mind personally on prosecutions yet. However, I am very strongly of the view that if we don't look hard at it now in a 9/11 commission way and more, that it will be a very grave error. And I actually think Obama probably wants to be pushed. It's really, I think it's up to people outside the White House, outside the circle of power around Obama to just push, just like many other things in politics are like that. I mean, you got to, it's really an organizing challenge as much as anything else. Let's get on to rebooting the news, because we're only amateur political pundits, you know?
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you, picking up on my last podcast, one of the questions on your list, which is, what's new with the top 40 tweets, or what are we calling it?
I call it the 40 Tweets Project.
Tell me what's giving an update on it. A lot of people are interested in it. There's definitely interest from the demand side.
Right. Well, there is, and I really hope to be able to offer it to more people. And that, I know that's a, that's different from what I said last week. Yeah. Because for a couple of reasons. Well, one is I had real serious server problems this week. And I didn't write about it, didn't tweet about it, I didn't do podcasts about it. It's hard for me to communicate about these things because people have a very vague idea of what a server is and how it operates and what those issues are. It doesn't mean the issues aren't there. They're there. And, you know, a good example of that was this week GeoCities announced that they were shutting down. Mm-hmm. And it's a related issue. I've been through this before. I've had to shut servers down. And I have a server. I only have two servers, basically. And one of them has been behaving badly. And I spent most of this week trying to figure out what the root of that problem was. And I never did really figure it out. I moved things around. I took down things. Whatever. So I know this is probably more information than you ever wanted to have on this, but the issue is this, okay? Is that when I operate one of these things, and there's a reason why I want to bring this up with you, because I want to ask you about this, is how long of a commitment am I making to do this? Mm-hmm. In other words, when I'm now hosting a page of yours, right? One page. And right. I host your editorial system for this, although you could resume your editorial system independent of that any day. If my service went away, you would be fine. You'd still be able to post links to Twitter. Mm-hmm. That page is probably never going to go away. As long as Amazon is there, it'll stay there because that's hosted in Amazon space. Mm-hmm. So that probably will never be an issue. Mm-hmm. But when I open it, and if I have a problem, I feel like I could probably call you up, and I can think of you as a friend. And, I could say, Jay, I've decided I don't want to do this anymore, And you'd probably be all right with that, right?
Yeah, sure, of course.
Yeah. But not everybody would. And so when I get to this point where, I get a lot of requests from people, would you release the source code? Would you host this? They don't quite ask the question so nicely, actually. They sort of assume that I'm going to do that. Now, what often happens when I do that is that, I open it up and, there are two extremes, both of which are fine. Nobody uses it. That actually, okay, it's a disappointment, but I can live with it.
Mm-hmm.
It takes off like a rocket ship. I love that. Okay, that means that I could probably raise some money and build out the servers and hire some programmers or whatever. But that almost never happens. Okay. Mm-hmm. Nor does the first one almost never happens too. Usually, it's right in the middle. And what and I know we hate those things where you have the A and the B on the one hand, usually it is straight in the middle, which means not many people use it. But enough people use it that it creates this pain in the ass going forever, basically. It's like, I don't want to run it anymore. I've moved on. It didn't work out, But there are all these people who have this expectation that, you made a commitment and you have to live up to it. Now, I put all these disclaimers. I've done this before. Put up all these disclaimers and say, I have no commitment. This thing could go away at any point in time. I've also developed systems where the content lives on your computer, not even in the cloud, and only the rendering exists in the cloud. And yet people still have, they still believe that I've made a commitment to host it for them. You know, so I do this with some trepidation. It has to feel to me like it's going to take off. And as you probably are aware, we hit some problems with the URL shortening service too this week also.
Yes.
Did you notice that?
There are bugs, yes. Yes, I did.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's a third party. So anyway, so...
So all people really want to know, though, Dave, and this is your point, is when can I get it?
That's correct. That's right. You got it. That's all they want to know. And they also...
I know, right. So when can they get it?
Thanks so much for understanding on behalf of all users, Jay. And, you know, I mean, us developers are really very happy to be so appreciated.
You know, here's how I would solve this problem.
Go ahead.
You're just going to tell me you already did this, but here's how I would solve the problem. I would say everything I'm doing is not only a demo, but it's what Marshall McLuhan used to call a probe. And I'm just trying to learn something. And my rule is when I learned it, the project is over.
Interesting.
But I'll let you go and, you know, carry on the project if you want to, you know, like whatever. If I don't keep it going, I'll make it open. And then you guys, if you think it's important, you do it. But I'm only in it to learn, so that's how I would.
Yes, and they'll ignore that when I say that. That would be.
Yeah, but you know what? The people who you said it and said it and said it, and they ignore it. That's really what a product of the internet itself. It's sort of the product of the parasocial nature of the internet. If it was face to face, they wouldn't be able to do that.
Correct.
So what's going on with the tool? So you want to get a small group of testers.
Well,
together,
yeah.
Or do you want to just release it and let anyone have one,
no,
or what
no,
do you want to
no,
do?
No, it won't go that route. That would be a dead end. Nobody would pick it up. I mean, I am very certain of that. If I went the latter route, it would absolutely gain no traction whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So what I will do is probably this week. I have my server is stabilized now, and it's running very smoothly. And so I feel like the next time I get, you know, sit down, I could probably put together the, you know, enough of an app. You know, it has to be also more streamlined, too, in order for more people to use it. Because there was an awful lot of hand coding that I did to get you up. By the way, we have a new user, Guy Kawasaki, who is, like, born to do this. I mean, he's already pushing huge numbers of links. And his numbers are an order of magnitude higher than yours and mine.
I would think so, yes.
But it's and he's a wonderful user. I've known Guy for like 25 years, and you know he pushes for new features, but he's very understanding. I you know love to get users like him, and so yeah. So probably what'll happen is you know I'll have put up the server next week, and then I'll announce on Twitter the next 10 people that go there and sign up will get through. Okay, after which. It'll stop. And then a few hours later, I'll say another 10 people can come through. So this gets past the problem of, like, you know, if I make the offer at 5 p.m. Pacific time, some guy in Europe is going to say, well, I was asleep when that happened, you know, so you need to, you know what I'm saying? So it has to be, I mean, you know, having been down this road several times, and I've got to somehow make it very clear. What did you call it, a probe? I have to say, this is a probe.
Yeah, a probe.
Think of me as Marshall McLuhan. And,
there you go.
You know.
All right.
Yeah.
I want to make sure we make good on our pledge to continue sources of inspiration.
Yeah.
I have an historical example I want
to
talk about, and you had somebody.
I get to go next. You
yeah.
Did one. You can
yeah.
One
so so you have your person. I want to hear about this person, and
sure.
And then I'll give you my historical example.
Well, this is a historical example. My guy is John Postel, and I think it's kind of interesting. You did a TV show, so you came from the media world, and I think it's important to understand that there's the tech world is here too, and John Postel is a hero of, there's no other word for what he is, a hero and a philosopher, great thinker. Unfortunately, he died right as the internet was beginning to become a very huge commercial entity. John Postel was, he sort of operated the internet, Jay, if you can believe it. It was when the internet was pretty small. It was a lot smaller than it is now. And the core system for the internet is what's called the domain name system, or DNS. It's the way names get resolved. So machines have two kinds of names, and the domain name system takes the easy human understandable name and turns it into a hardware address that computers are good at understanding. Mm-hmm. And John Postel was one of the designers of the domain name system. He also started the system called the RFCs, Request for Comment, which is a precursor of blogging, of discussion groups, of every form of interaction that we have on the internet. You can trace it all back to the RFC, the philosophy of RFCs. It's a very soft sort of thing. It says, basically, what I'm interested in is knowing what you have to say about this. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of, there's a lot of IMHO, in my humble opinion, that goes with that as well. Mm-hmm. Now, and Postel, so, I mean, he has a long list of accomplishments, and I don't want to, like, go into all of those, because I guess we want to stay sort of not too technical. But he has this, what's called called Postel's Law. And Postel's Law goes like this. Be conservative in what you send and liberal in what you receive. And it's what it meant basically was don't invent a new protocol. Don't invent new protocols. If you can, I suppose you'd have to add, if you can possibly avoid it. Although there's nothing in there about possibly avoiding it. And as I said in the piece that I wrote about Postel, is every time I think I've come up with some piece of wisdom that I want to pass on to future generations, on a few moments of reflection, I realize that it's just another way of saying Postel's Law. That almost everything that we hit, and, you know, there's other philosophies of, you know, worse is better, keep it very low-tech. You know, the internet protocols are all designed, it's like the operating system Unix is where it all comes from. And, you know, I remember as a grad student in the mid-70s at the University of Wisconsin, we had Unix there, and we had the source code for it, and there was no concept of open source, but people generally just gave you the source code to what they were working on. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading the source code of Unix and thinking that it was so simple and it was so airy and so just straightforward. And I always wanted to write code like that. That was...
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and that's the point. It does make... When you read it, you go, how could something that makes so much sense actually do something, you know? Because the code I had been writing up to that point was nothing like that.
Let me ask you a question about Postel.
Yeah.
And what he said. In your blog post on it, you had it the other way. You just said his law was be conservative in what you send and liberal in what you accept.
Yeah.
At Scripty News, you said be liberal in what you accept and conservative in what you send.
I just so reversed what the
did
order.
What did he say?
I just reversed the order of the two in what I just stated. I didn't change the law.
Right.
Yeah.
So which one was it? Postel's law is which way?
Well, it's the same thing. It's like if I say, you know, take out the garbage and brush your teeth, that's the same thing as saying brush your teeth and take out the garbage.
Right.
There's no difference between the two laws. It's the important thing is you do one with what you send and you do the other with what you receive.
Okay, I got a historical connection for you.
Sure.
Between Postel's law, which I love and I think is brilliant, and I also loved your description of him and what he created. It reminds me of something about Jefferson. Jefferson, in the way he thought about how the government should work, had a very complex mind, and he believed many different things. But one of the principles that you see him trying to struggle to again and again is that simplicity in public affairs was absolutely essential to liberty and to having a government that was consent of the governed. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of things followed for him from that. For example, And they were not necessarily good ideas, but they were part of this principle of simplicity. He thought, let's keep our workmen in Europe. Let's have manufacturing stay there, because when we have these complex cities and stuff, it's very hard for people to understand their government. It's very, and people who are dependent on in that way are hard to make into good citizens. And so his idea of how to keep the public informed was to keep the government simple. He was against debt, a lot of debt, because he thought it would be hard for people to understand what their government was doing when they had to calculate something like that in, right? And by keeping government close to the people, he hoped to keep it simple for everybody to understand, because he knew that lots of people were coming from different entry points, right? And so the whole idea of simplicity is related to participation, mm-hmm. which is related to equality of stake, right? In the system, in the technology, in the government, in the system of power.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I like about your approach to technology, the way you blog, the way you think, the way you write code, although I don't understand code, but the kinds of things that you invent, is that they're about making it simple for people to participate,
yeah.
which is an extremely democratic thing. And one of the reasons that we have these conversations is that my whole thing in journalism is to say, you guys got the order of things wrong. It's not that people need information to participate. It's that when people participate, they see why they need information.
Yeah,
and so
that's
if you want to,
no, I was getting goosebumps, you know, while you were telling I was literally getting goosebumps while you were telling the Jefferson story, because what you were saying is so right, and it applies today. And I think I understand who was getting in the way of what Jefferson wanted to do. Because
sure, there's a lot of opponents to that.
Right, I'll tell you, because it happens, right? And this is one of the reasons why, I mean, you know, not to get out the violins or anything, because I can deal with it, but this is why I get so much, like, mud slung at me, because it threatens people. There's a lot of, like, for example, like, there were some very large tech companies that had, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of business consulting with the publishing industry to help them sort through all of the different crazy stuff they had to do to syndicate their content. And
yeah, right.
Right. And when RSS popped up, guess what these people saw when they saw it? They didn't like it one bit, because they saw the hundreds of millions of dollars going away. Because you wouldn't need all that consulting and all that sort of Tower of Babel of technology, because it wasn't very complicated. You could write a parser for RSS in, you know, an afternoon.
If you want to scramble the politics of any institution, Dave,
oh man, it was
just
like,
divide the people who are pro simplicity versus pro complexity.
Right, yeah, but there usually are very small number of people who are pro simplicity. It's usually very small, and they're usually broke. Okay, they're usually not making the money.
Well, yeah,
and you know, what was I going to say?
Sources of inspiration.
Oh, I know. I want to say I witnessed this firsthand in the development of something called SOAP, Simple Object Access Protocol, which was anything but simple, and it transitioned from what I developed with two Microsoft engineers and another guy like me who wasn't at Microsoft. We did it in like three sessions over 2 weeks, and it was called XMLRPC, and it worked great. And then it took two or three years to turn that into SOAP, and in the process, we got Sun Microsystems, IBM, the entirety of Microsoft into the loop on this stuff, and it became completely perverted, impossible to implement, which was exactly what they wanted. They wanted it to be impossible to implement so that they could charge all the money, you know. And so this is what I don't know. Remember we were sitting in a Starbucks probably about a year ago, and I was saying, Jay, I think you need to understand how the tech industry works. And you were going, nah, I don't need to understand it. You don't actually need to because you already have this model. You know, we already, all I have to do is, from now on, is just say, think Jefferson and you'll understand what you're up against because you're one of those users when it comes to this stuff, right? I want you to understand the technology so that if you can understand it, because I know you can, because you're smart and the stuff isn't really complicated, right? Then I know that, you know, what do I know? Actually, that's actually a really good question. Why do I want you to understand it?
Because, exactly. Why do you keep asking me that?
Well,
because everybody wants to be joined in their projects.
No,
and their,
I know why. No. Of course, I want you to appreciate it, but that isn't the reason why. The reason why is because I personally constantly get into these battles, okay, right? And I lose them, right? I lose them because I get users telling me, oh, I don't care about that stuff, right? Well, the fact is that if enough users actually did take the time to understand it and care about it, I wouldn't lose. And it's not so much that I like to win, which I do like to win, okay? But it's like you will lose too. And that's the problem, right? Is if something can happen and it's wonderful, right? But you don't even know about it. This goes back to the information stuff. You don't even know it's possible. Then you're never going to have an opinion about it. And then you know what's going to happen? I'm going to tell you, oh, this thing's great. You need to try it. And some other schmuck is going to come along and say, oh, it's too complicated. You can't understand that. And now you have a problem, okay? You have to decide who's telling you the truth. I'm saying, no, you can understand it. And he's telling you no. And your answer is, I don't give a shit. And I go, thank you so much. So that's
all right. Well, we got to move on because...
All right. Thank you.
We'll come back to these frustrations because it's...
Wait. Before we move on, let me just say this. John Postel made it fucking work, okay?
Yeah.
He made the internet work, and it's why we're having all this fun right now. And we owe him a debt of gratitude, I say, number one. And number two is it's his philosophy is another instance of the thing that actually makes cool stuff happen.
So in that respect, the reason we cite him as an inspiration in this series is
right.
Because we need to go back to,
yes, because
to get a new system of news.
That's correct. And I,
okay,
and
we'll
point,
make the point,
right,
man.
Okay, I was just about to go there. Jeez. The point is, but thank you so much.
You're supposed to be a professional.
Well, please, I'm an amateur. When it comes to this news stuff, I'm not a professional. Yes.
So how is he an inspiration for a new system of news?
When we reboot the news... It's probably going to obey Postel's law. When it actually all comes together, it's going to be another...
Because that is good editing. That is what editing is. Editing is bringing in a lot and letting out a little.
Aha, interesting. Yes.
That is what an editor is. That is what an intelligent filter is. What we have to discover now is what is an intelligent filter in 2009? And how intelligent can we make it? And how many people can participate in that? And how do we use what we know to make it more intelligent?
But I think the intelligence, the answer of where we get the intelligence from is kind of like staring us in the face. Intelligence comes from people.
Right. People hooked up properly together.
Excuse me, only intelligent people. You can't get intelligence from stupid people, unfortunately.
I have my source of inspiration I want to add.
Go for it.
Which I think we could probably hook back around and connect to the conversation we've had so far. When I try to imagine new systems... I find it impossible to go into the future. People always ask me, what's going to happen? And I usually tell them, I have no idea. And I find it very hard to think into the future. But when I'm trying to imagine what's possible, I like to go back to the past. So, and in graduate school, I studied the history of media, which is basically a history of technology platforms changing. from oral cultures to writing cultures to literacy and print culture to the beginnings of the electronic world and then on to computers. Computers are like the last 2% of the story. And in that work, I came across this distinction that Raymond Williams, another source of inspiration, makes between what he calls technology and cultural form. In a book called Television, Technology, and Cultural Form, he says that very often when we look at technologies, we think we're seeing the machine, but we're actually seeing a cultural form because the technologies can be used lots of different ways. And the ways they end up being using is actually not usually a property of the technology, but of us. And that's why he wants to call it a cultural form. And is the concept...
You just went away there.
Oh.
Repeat the last sentence or the last phrase because somehow you just disappeared.
He says when we look at a technology, we often think it's the technology when it's actually a cultural form.
Okay.
So an example he gives is... the concept of flow in television, which is a big word for you, and it was a big word for him.
Csikszentmihalyi, right?
Mm-hmm. Sociology developed this notion of flow
pretty
deeply. Yeah. And Williams was interested in flow as a property of the way commercial broadcasting structured television, because its whole thing was to keep you watching, right?
Yeah.
So things had to flow seamlessly.
You just went away.
From segment to segment.
You just went away again. Something's bad.
Oh.
We gotta.
Darn.
You just went totally dead. Okay, but something about flow in TV or something?
He said. He pointed to the way that broadcast television flowed seamlessly from program to program and ad to content. And he identified flow as something the commercial producers of television wanted. It was more of a cultural form, not necessarily a property of the technology. So in thinking about this distinction between technology and cultural form, I came across this example of the Four Minute Men in World War I. And the Four Minute Men were volunteers that were hired by the Committee on Public Information, which was Woodrow Wilson's message machine or propaganda unit. And their job was to basically make the president's case for war, for the United States being on the right side and for eventually entering the World War I. And this was before radio made it easy to go into everyone's home, before there was television. And the Four Minute Men were a distributed army of volunteers who would give speeches in public places like movie theaters and lodges and other places people gathered. And the Committee on Public Information set up a system where they would basically transmit instructions on what to say. And these volunteers would get up and give the president's message, give the president's case for war. Now, it was a propaganda effort. It was totally controlled from the center. And it was an attempt to broadcast before there was the technology of broadcasting. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
It was an attempt to take a message, synthesize at the center, and distribute it around a fragmented country, which it was Wilson. And that country was populated by lots of immigrants, people who had different kinds of identities, different kinds of loyalties. They weren't all that sure they should be in this war. They weren't all that sure which side they should be on. And Wilson's job was to get his message to this fragmented country in a very consistent way with a maximum of control from the center, but also agency and creativity at the ends of the network. So he needed a network before there were any networking tools. And so the cultural form of broadcasting, of one-to-many communication, of command and control from the center was there before the tools to actually bring it about. And so when we think about rebooting the news, we should not follow the lesson or example of a propaganda machinery, instead we should realize that we can start thinking of the right form even before we have the tools. We can start imagining how a new system of news works and then find the technology. And the ability to imagine the system first is what created the Four Minute Men. And then they found the people who could actually do it. And it was an effective broadcasting system before the technology.
Well, that's often how it goes. I call that paving the cow path. If you look at Interstate 80, I can see it out my window here. At one point, 200 years ago, that was probably there, but it wasn't. It wasn't eight lanes and, an interchange connecting to the Bay Bridge. It wasn't this fancy thing, but that's how we build things. And that's one of the ways I develop stuff, is that first you have to do it manually and then you automate it. So it's perfectly rational to go that route. And that is, in fact, how things almost always seem to work.
First you do it manually, and then you automate it.
Well,
then
you understand what the issues are. Once you've actually done it manually, you understand when you have a solution, because you've already had the problem, and it's a sort of rational way to go. Which leads me, now we're at 41 minutes, so we probably should wrap up, but I'll tell you, while you were telling this great story, you did break up like three times, and it still made sense, but while you were doing that, I thought, okay, I can visualize something about rebooting the news, that we're going to do is we're going to figure out how to do these podcasts so that the levels work, because I'm pretty sure you're a lot louder than I am today, even though I'm making an effort to try to talk loud, and I've jacked up every level I have at my disposal here to its max. It's still
not good.
So one of the things that we need in the rebooting the news system is a commercial way to do what we're doing right now, not this jury-rigged system that I have here that depends on a lot of technical knowledge, and yet still after 7 weeks the result is pretty sketchy. So I'm going to put some time in this week to trying to figure out how to make this better, and probably going to talk to some people and see what we can't do, But let's put that on the list, that this thing itself is a cow path. What we're doing here is something that in the 4 or 5 years we've been doing podcasting, it really isn't gotten any better. And so I'd like to work on that.
Maybe you should edit it and edit that part out. We don't really have a way to easily
do it. No, I won't do that. I don't have the time, and I don't think that's the answer. I'm not going to edit that, no.
Yeah.
Let's not drift off, okay?
All right.
We like to end in a very punctual way, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we are, even with our technical struggles, rebooting the news.
We hope so, yeah. Well, we are. Okay, Jay.
You yourself are a source of inspiration. Good night.
Oh, thanks, Jay. You too. Bye-bye.